KSI in the world. I'm John Batchelor. From the surface of the planet Earth, we're headed with Bob Zimmerman to the surface of the planet Mars. Almost the surface. Now and again the surface. Ingenuity. Flight 43, the brave little toaster that has set a new standard for exploring Mars. Now that we know you can fly in the atmosphere and that the solar panels on Ingenuity do not choke up the way they did on Oppie and Spirit, not yet anyway. Bob, a very good evening to you. I celebrate Ingenuity because this is the surprise of the mission. Perseverance, the hard extracting miner, we understood its major mission, but Ingenuity was only supposed to last, what, 90 days, 30 days? Good evening to you, Bob.
Good evening, John. First of all, I must thank your listeners for their generous support during my short two-week fundraising campaign this February. I shortened the campaign to only 2 weeks because I'm tired of begging, and your readers, listeners responded very, very generously, and I really appreciate that, supporting Behind the Black. It's really appreciated. It's forget about the financial end. It just tells me there's a lot of people who like what I'm doing, and I really appreciate that. So, yes, Ingenuity, the key is it just completed its 43rd flight. It was the longest flight in almost a year, and the reason that it hadn't flown so long in a year is because for the past 8 months or so, it's been winter on Mars. You mentioned the problems of solar panels with Spirit and Opportunity, and basically Ingenuity was facing the same problems. It was getting less light, and the dust season in the winter was the storm season was putting dust on the panels and also blocking light from the sun. And so Ingenuity was actually not waking up as it should repeatedly in the mornings. And it went through a few periods where they didn't think it would come back to life. But they were always able to get back to life and managed to do some flights, short flights, during the winter, but nothing very long. But winter's over now. And so they did the 43rd flight. It flew for just under 2.5 minutes, and it flew to almost 1,300 feet. And in both time and distance, it went actually farther than planned. And that's the longer distance in time is almost certainly the helicopter trying to find the landing spot. I've got a map on Behind the Black to show approximately where the direction it was traveling and how far. They haven't yet released the exact landing site yet, so I can't show that. But nonetheless, it's now on the move, and it's now ahead of Perseverance, and it's taking images as it goes to help the Perseverance team find a route to travel. What's, as you indicated, John, what's significant about Ingenuity is it was supposed to fly for 30 days, only 30 days, and only maybe make a half a dozen test flights, and it was just simply proof of concept. You could fly on Mars. But these engineers and the designers of Ingenuity have far exceeded that. It has now lasted 2 years, and it's completed 43 flights. What is that? That's 7 times the number of flights, and it's traveled almost 5.5 miles. This is an amazing engineering achievement by JPL's engineering team, and they should be very, very proud of what they've accomplished.
Theoretically, Bob, Ingenuity is capable of circling Mars and flying forever, yes?
Maybe. It's got through the winter. So there really isn't based on how it works with solar panels, there isn't really a limit. Unlike the rovers, it does have its own honed wind machine to blow off the dust. So, yes, this thing could possibly go for as long as necessary. But you got to remember, it communicates through Perseverance. So it can't go farther away from Perseverance. It can never do that. It has to stay in this particular range. Future helicopters, different story, John.
Does its camera, so the camera only works because Perseverance gives it the order, is that correct? It doesn't have any...
No, it's that communications are relayed through Perseverance. And so it has its own computer setup, I'm sure of that, but you got to send the data back and forth through Perseverance, and you got to send your commands through Perseverance. It's the relay information.
I see.
So that's basically it.
It can't go off by itself, collect a lot of data, fly back to Perseverance and download it. You can't do that.
I would think that's difficult, if not impossible, yeah.
All right, let's future Ingenuities, circling Mars. We go to Perseverance itself, the miner, the extractor, the Glencore on Mars. How's it doing, Bob?
Well, they released a great mosaic, which I posted on Behind the Black with a map to show you where that it's looking. This is a mosaic panorama showing all the core samples deposited on the floor of Jezero crater for eventual pickup by future Mars helicopters, much more capable helicopters that have now will be using the engineering developed and first tested by Ingenuity. And so you get to see where they're placed and get an idea of how they've been put down. They've been spaced out very carefully in a complex pattern so that not right on top of each other. The positions are very well mapped, and this will allow one giving information for future helicopters to find them should they get covered by dust, but also to not land on any of these core samples by accident. They can get each one separately, future helicopters. This is very well planned out.
There, in your photograph, Bob, we see the tracks of Perseverance crossing this landscape that looks like a desert with a mesa in the background. And there's one little one called Amalek. Is that a vial? Is that what everybody
has? That's the core sample. All the picture shows a whole bunch of samples circled, but the only one that's really obviously to see is the closest one, Amalek, which is a core sample. They all look like that. They're basically tubes that have the core samples inside. Perseverance, by the way, has a duplicate core sample taken from the same location for each one of these. So push comes to shove, all the core samples obtained will also be on Perseverance. So if they can't get the core samples that are left behind on the ground, they can go to Perseverance, wherever it is at this time, and pick up the samples then.
What's in the core samples? Do we have a theory about what we're looking for, or is it all
Well,
rock?
Eight of the tubes contain rock and regolith. That's basically the core sample plus the surface soil or dirt. One is an atmospheric sample, and that's just simply empty, but they allow the marsh an atmosphere in and then sealed the tube. And a final one is called a witness tube, which I suspect is a baseline tube. They didn't open at all. And so you could see what it is without anything in it in any case. So it's a control sample, essentially. And so that's what the tubes contain. They're core samples, and they know the locations of each, and they're at different points in Jezero crater, including close to the edge of the delta. And so you get specific information from each one of them.
Another piece of information that isn't obvious, but I want to celebrate it. It looks like easy traveling terrain. Is this what it's going to be like the rest of the journey, Bob, over this same
Well, you're asking me how many miles of unexplored passage are in this cave. I can't answer that clearly, but I can tell you that at least for the near future, I don't see any terrain that Perseverance has to travel on that is anywhere near as rough as what Curiosity is routinely traveling on. The delta is probably some form of mud or debris that flowed out into the crater, and therefore it's probably not as rocky. And so, this has been interesting to me because the Perseverance science team has actually seemed to me incredibly cautious and conservative compared to the Curiosity team, when they themselves have better wheels, Perseverance, and a much nicer terrain to travel over. They've been really careful, and I don't think they need to be so careful. But, I can't speak for the details. They know more than I do about why they're doing what they're doing.
James Webb, information that I've never seen before. This looks like a spider's web. What am I looking at, Bob?
I will tell you that in the past you actually have seen stuff like this because the Spitzer Infrared Space Telescope did the same kind of thing, but with much less resolution and with less abilities. But Webb has taken an they have a project going on to observe 19 spiral galaxies relatively close to the Milky Way, and using Webb to do this and in collaboration with other telescopes. And the idea is the infrared abilities can look at the dust and gas and star formation in a galaxy, something that will not stand out in a Hubble image. And so this is one of the pictures from this survey of a galaxy that's about 46 million miles away. And what you're looking at, the galaxy really is in the center here, and it's a barred spiral. Everything that's kind of spread out around it is less distinct than surrounding terrain. The center section might actually be the nucleus, but I don't think so. I post a link to the Hubble image so people can compare the two. Webb doesn't have the resolution of of Hubble, but it's not designed to do that. It's designed to look at a different wavelength to get different information. And this is telling us something about the complex structures of the dust and gas in galaxies. And this will teach a lot about how galaxies form and evolve over time, John.
From 7,000 light years away is the way I read that picture. We're going to the far side of the moon, Chang'e 4, right? Chang'e 4. And the Chinese space program has been cautious about releasing material, but have they changed, Bob?
They haven't changed, but they're not particularly, they don't make it easy. They have been, over time, releasing data from all their planetary missions, and so they have just released another set of data from the Chang'e 4 lander as well as U-2-2, the rover that went down with it. And this is data that covers most of 22 that was collected for the period of 22. And yes, they release the data for the world to use. They don't provide the website. I had to go searching to find out where the link was. The link, though, is in Chinese. They have an English, supposedly, version, but you can't access it. My web browser says this is not available, unavailable. So if you read Chinese, you can get this data set much more easily. If you don't, you're going to have to get someone who does read Chinese so you'll know what you're downloading or where to go to download it. But they have been releasing the data. This is covering through the beginning of 22. So for the last year or so, that data has not been released yet.
We go to asteroids falling to Earth. Our shooting star falls to Earth. However, there is information here that's consistent with the planetary defenses. A Hungarian astronomer spotted an asteroid. The timing is the breakthrough. What happened, Bob?
This is actually the seventh time this has happened, but it's only happened recently in the last, like, decade. This Hungarian astronomer spotted the asteroid mere hours before it was going to hit the Earth. And so they were able to actually track where it would fly, and there's a lot of video on the web of its flight over Europe. A lot of people in England and France got great videos of this meteorite burning up in the atmosphere. It looks pretty spectacular. And then, because they knew how it came down, people in France, a volunteer citizen amateur astronomer group, they went out and searched for it in the area where they thought it came down, and lo and behold, one of them found the asteroid, and they got it. So this is the seventh time they've been able to grab an asteroid shortly after landing. And that's significant because there was therefore no time other than flying through the atmosphere that this asteroid could be eroded or changed by the Earth. And that's good good for the science community because they can now quickly learn something about the asteroids with less change from the Earth's environment, John.
What I learned, Bob, is how many people are idly pointing their iPhones at the sky for no particular reason at any one moment, because the passage of the asteroid was spectacular, but you didn't have any warning to get the iPhone out. They're just sort of randomly taking pictures of the dark sky, and then all of a sudden you have...
A lot of cases, that's the case. It's random. But I would tell you that a lot of those videos of the action was not random, because the amateur astronomy community was keyed in on where their thing was probably going to be coming across, knew it was going to be coming across at a certain time and place approximately, and they were there waiting and hoping they could spot it, and that's why they got it.
I thought, well, all right. I didn't check where they were. I thought it was Scotland. There was some soundtrack, too. They were all surprised, but maybe it was the amateurs. Now we go to the surface of Mars. Bob enjoys looking at things that we can't possibly interpret. What are we seeing here, Bob?
I got two cool images on behind the black that I found from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter archive. One is one I call "What the Heck Swirls on Mars." Don't ask me. I haven't the faintest idea. This could be lava. But that's a guess. That's totally a guess. It's just geology that makes no sense to me at all. And we're talking about swirls and moves and humps and badlands that are just really strange looking. And then the other one is the endless volcanic ash fields of Mars in its volcano country. This is a gigantic ash deposit, the biggest on Mars. They think most of the dust on Mars comes from this ash deposit. And so there's, and sometimes it's just endless ash deposit. And I got a picture of that just to give a sense of what it's like. It's several hundred feet deep in many places, as deep as 1,000 feet in some spots. And so that's just Mars, an alien planet, John.
So you think that ash is 1,000 feet deep, and if anything landed on it, it'd sink into it into a pillow?
No, not necessarily. It's in some places 1,000 feet deep, but this is ash that, you know, has been there for a while and become compacted or hardened. There are some places where we don't know. It could be loose. You could sink in. But I think in most cases, it would not be that. It would be, you wouldn't sink in very far.
Bob Zimmerman, he keeps the website Behind the Black. He spends a lot of time on the surface of Mars, some on the far side of the moon. We're headed to the engineering that takes us to the moon and Mars and beyond. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Over the past few years, the COVID-19 pandemic has affected how we live our daily lives. Today, we also face a mental health pandemic that threatens our well-being as we attempt to rebuild our social networks and communities.
The pandemic has reminded us to value family, community, and our human connections. However, it has also left many of us feeling more isolated, confused, and alone, struggling to find meaning amid loss and uncertainty.
Today, 1 in 5 Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges. But many of us do not understand what we are facing or know how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we understand what you are going through, and we are here to help. Our vision is to build a mentally healthy nation for all. We work every day to eliminate stigma, combat mental illness and substance use disorders, and advance mental health. If you or someone you love needs help, you are not alone. Please visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
Take a look under your bed. Find stuff under there? What about jobs? No? Now try your basement. There's a pair of overalls that overall you're not so into anymore. A perfectly good laptop that hasn't sat in your lap in months. And even more stuff, but still no jobs? Well, you really have both. See, stuff is defined as household articles considered as a group. Sometimes this stuff is no longer needed. Wait, no longer needed? That can't be right. Because remember those jobs you were looking for? Those are really needed, and they're the stuff inside your stuff. Even inside that winter coat that moved with you to Phoenix. Our job is to unlock those jobs, and it starts when you donate your stuff to your local Goodwill. Here's how we do it. When you donate to Goodwill, we sell your stuff to provide job training for people right here in your community. So just by teaming up with Goodwill, you help create jobs. And isn't that worth parting with the leftover keytar from your 80s cover band? Goodwill. Donate stuff, create jobs. Find your nearest donation center at goodwill.org. A message from Goodwill and the Ad Council.